Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Maureen, your Canva presentation looks brilliant. Thanks, Brett. That's because I used AI-powered Canva presentations. I just described what I wanted, and Canva presentations generated the perfect slides. You can even make a talking presentation for people to watch on their own time. Check this out. Recording. 101 Reasons Why Beaches is the Saddest Film Ever Made by your neighbour Maureen. Is it easy to use? If you can use a computer, you can nail your next work presentation with Canva Presentations at canva.com, designed for work. Oh, thanks, my neighbour Maureen. Yeah, thank you.
Look, 8 is only films to be parried with.
Hello and welcome to Films to be Buried With. My name is Brett Goldstein. I'm a comedian, an actor, a writer, a director, an L joint, and I love films. As Amit Kalantri once said, your actions speak so loudly, you need not say anything else. But do let me know if you enjoyed Mamma Mia, Here We Go Again, because I think that also speaks highly of your character. Yeah, I'd agree with that actually. Pretty lame to be too cool for Mamma Mia 2. Nice one, Amit. Every week, I invite a special guest over. I tell them they've died, then I get them to discuss their life through the films that meant the most to them. Previous guests include Sharon Stone, James Acaster, Kevin Smith, and even Yet Uambles. But this week, it's the brilliant producer, writer, and director, Mr. Neil Marshall. Get over to the Patreon at patreon.com/Brett Goldstein, where you'll get an extra 15 minutes with Neil. We chat about openings and closings. He tells a secret. It's a pretty good one, actually, that secret. You get all of that, and you also get the whole episode uncut and ad-free and as a video. Check it out over at patreon.com/Brett Goldstein. Your two TV missions, if you've not seen them already, are to watch season one of Ted Lasso on the Apple TV Plus app and season one of Soulmates on Amazon Prime. One will make you happy, the other will make you question your partner. So, Neil Marshall. Neil Marshall is a writer, director, producer who's made some extraordinary films like Dog Soldiers and The Descent, and also directed killer episodes of Game of Thrones, amongst many other things. We recorded this over Zoom a few weeks ago. He was brilliant. He fully indulged me in chat about The Descent, which I think is one of the great horrors. So if you've not seen The Descent yet, watch it before you listen to this, because he gives some real diamonds about the making of that film. It's really worth having a look before you listen to this. I think that's all you need to know. So that is it for now. I very much hope you enjoy episode 145 of Films to be Buried With. Hello and welcome to Films to be Buried With. It is me, Brett Goldstein, and I'm joined today by an executive producer, an editor, a writer, a producer, a director, a hero, and a legend in the film industry. Please welcome to the show the brilliant Mr. Neil Marshall!
Woo! I didn't know that I had that many credits.
Quite a lot of credits. I actually had a look at your IMDb. It was exhausting. Yeah. It was an exhausting read.
The longer the list, the older you are.
How are you?
I'm good.
You're in Budapest. Can you tell us a bit about that?
I'm going to be shooting a movie here in July. So I'm just doing a little bit of early scouting of locations.
Can you tell us anything about the movie?
I can tell you it's called The Lair, and it is another horror movie.
Good.
Kind of, you know, more akin, I suppose, to the kind of movies I started out in. Lots of blood and guts and mayhem and chaos.
Would it annoy you if we talked about The Descent for a bit?
Of course not.
Are you bored of talking about The Descent?
No, it's something I'm incredibly proud of. So the fact that people still want to talk about it is, I'm fine with that.
I think The Descent is fucking excellent. I think it was one of the best cinema experiences I had. And one of the reasons I love and respect it so massively. Correct me if I'm wrong, but that is a film made for cinema, and you did no cheating with the lights. Is that right? So it's all set in caves underground, and it is lit by what is there, as in fire or torches or cameras. There's never fake lights suddenly appearing to illuminate stuff. Is that true?
That was absolutely the plan. That was what I worked out, because I was working that out with the DP while I was writing the script. So I wrote the script based around which character would have which source of light in which scene and try and track them.
Yeah.
But also trying to figure out as a way of visual identification of like certain characters would have different things. Like one's got a green snap light, one's got fire, one's got a video camera. So you kind of know where you were because of the light source. And we said right from the start, we said, because we went caving. I'd been caving a few times before, but I went caving with the cast. Proper spelunking caving up in Derbyshire with the cast. And it was that thing of like, I want to be authentic to what it's like down a cave, which is that if you haven't got any light with you, it is black beyond belief. Like it is just so dark that, you know, you can stand there, your eyes are wide open, you can wave your hand right in front of your eyes and you can't see a thing. There's no light. And so many movies that are set underground in caves or whatever always have these like beautiful shafts of light and no obvious source. And I said, we're not going to do that. And I also thought it would help with the claustrophobia angle of it, of like if you have a huge black screen and just this little pinpoint source of light of somebody with a match or somebody with a flare or whatever it is, that, and then see how it lights up the rest of the set. But all that said, we never shot any of it in a single, you know, in a real cave. It was all done set in pine wood.
I don't mind that bit. But it's also like, it's a really hard film to replicate at home because it's hard to make your house as dark as a cinema as well.
True. Go and hide in a closet or something. Go and hide in a cupboard and watch it.
Yeah. You need to watch it under the duvet or something. But it's so impressive, that film. And I went with my friend Amphi, and it was one of the great moments where she screamed so loud that then the whole audience screamed after she'd screamed. Like, the film made her jump, she screamed, then everyone screamed at her scream. It was really great.
It had people on edge. Yeah, it was kind of underestimating just how many people are claustrophobic.
Yeah.
You know, I kind of figured about sort of 2 or 3 out of 10, and it's actually more like 9 out of 10.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we hit a nerve.
The other thing I wanted to ask about it is that I always say, and I think it mostly, I don't like violence, right? I don't really like seeing violence. I often find it quite upsetting. Do you know what I mean? I'm a sensitive soul. And sometimes I don't like seeing people I don't like torture porn as a genre. It's not my cup of tea, right? However, The Descent.
Me neither.
The Descent, which is incredibly violent in the second towards the end.
Mm-hmm.
I love it. And I found it incredibly satisfying. And at no point was I like, oh, this is, and why do you think that is? I got a theory, but I want to hear yours.
I think my theory might be to do that most of the violence is perpetrated against the creatures, and they're mm-hmm. kind of, they're not people. When it's not people, you know, violence against people is always pretty harsh.
Yeah.
But then, you know, as soon as it becomes something else, even if it's like a vampire or a crawler or a zombie or whatever, it kind of takes it to that. Just one distance away from reality, so one step away from reality. I think the other thing is that you want those girls to start kind of hitting back by the end of the film.
Yeah, you really earn it. You earn that. We so want them to survive. And you've really invested us in them. And it's fucking scary. And then it's really satisfying. It's great.
We put them through hell and they kind of deserved a little bit of payback.
Yeah, brilliant. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Anyway, I've forgotten to tell you something. And I feel like a dickhead, actually, because I've just been sort of praising your work and stuff. But I, very stupidly, I should have said this first when you came on the Zoom. And what a plum. What an absolute idiot. I'll just have to
say it. Can you edit around it?
No, well, I'll just say it and we'll see how we go. I'll say it. You've died. You're dead.
I know. It's a terrible thing. It doesn't feel good.
No. How did you die?
I was eaten by one of my own monsters.
Yes.
I'm a big fan of practical effects, and mm-hmm. I think I just took it that one step too far. And my own creation came back to bite me and bite and bite and bite and bite. And that was it. You know, I was all gone.
Which one was it in particular?
I'd say it was probably one of the crawlers, which is like, you know, underground, you know, cannibalistic dudes. What a way to go. End up crawler bait.
Killed by your own crawler.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a beautiful death, and it is not, and I have to say, it's never come up on this podcast before, so I'm a huge fan.
I don't know if there's something poetic about it. It's like, you know, Frankenstein or whatever, being killed by his own creation. It's like...
Yeah. It's deep.
But messy. Very messy.
It's deep and messy. Do you worry about death, Neil Marshall?
I think I've only started worrying about it since I turned 50.
Right.
But it's not like the actual... I don't really want to, you know, die a painful death. It's more that I still feel like I have so much to do, so I've just got to really crack on with stuff. Yeah. And it's like, you know, this is finite, our little time on Earth, and I need to stay busy. Yeah. That's more it's thing. I've always been one of these people, like, I don't particularly like having a lie-in. If I can, I want to get up and I want to start working, and I've always just been had a busy mind of, like, I have things to create, I have things to do, and I have trouble switching off, which is... The biggest problem is that it's 24 hours, you know, 24/7 is just ideas and thoughts and things like that, and making some time to sleep. So it's more the idea that time is going to run out at some point.
Were you always this way? Were you always the way, what you've just described of 24/7, were you always that?
Yeah, always. Yeah. Even like when I was a little kid, whatever, I'd be waking up very early in the morning. I'd be straight into the Lego and start building stuff. And, you know, be building things for a few hours before breakfast, you know, it's like, and then start painting, or then I start, you know, doing something else. So yeah, it's always been that, not necessarily being good at any of it, but just doing it, you know?
Did you ever have, because you're one of these people that I think is very inspirational. Like as far as I understand, you're not from a background, your family weren't in this business. Is that you had no
artistic background, I suppose. Like my granddad was an artist. My dad was a commercial artist as well. Brilliant. Okay. Calligrapher, amazing watercolor painter, stuff like that. It's very much the, you know, that side of things. So I'm the first one to go into the media business, to go into movies. Yeah.
And you just sort of made it happen. You just made shit happen. Did you ever have doubt?
No. The thing is, it's. I've heard so many people tell the same story now. It sounds like such a cliche, but yes, I did go and see. I saw Raiders of the Lost Ark when I was 11 years old. I saw the making of Raiders on TV, and myself and my best friend Mike were both equally inspired. And we got hold of his mum's Super 8 cine camera, and for the next, like, you know, 8 years or whatever, our teenage years, we were making films. We were acting in them, directing in them, writing them. We were doing special effects and miniatures and props and just, you know, the full thing, just ourselves. And, and I never really looked back. It was like, okay, this is what I want to do from now on. And somehow or other, I've managed to make it work, you know?
Incredible. I love it. What do you think happens when you die? Do you think there's an afterlife?
Food for worms, I think. I think life goes on, but in the cyclical way of, like, well, we just go back to the earth, and then, you know, plants and trees will sprout from us and such like. And I think I'm fine with that. Yeah, I'm not a big believer in a higher power, unless nature is a higher power. So, you know, I guess that's fine. I wouldn't mind coming back as a tree. If I could come back as a tree, that'd be good.
Okay,
as long as I didn't get, you know, cut down.
Let me have a word. Well, I got good news for you, or bad news, to be honest. I don't know. I can't really get your take on it. There is a heaven. There's a whole afterlife. You don't get to be a tree yet. Yeah, there's a heaven.
Can I keep on, like, making films and working there?
Yeah, actually.
Presumably, they'd all be good.
Yeah, they're the best. The best of the best.
It'll be really good.
There's a studio. I've added that in.
Excellent. Now.
Yeah. There's a studio, the best crews. Everyone's excited to work. They're all invested in whatever the project is.
The only downside about that is that I'll never get any rest.
But you'll have unlimited energy because it's heaven.
That's fine. I won't need rest. I won't need to sleep anymore.
The thing is, whilst you're up there making all these films, I'm very excited about this, by the way. I'm really excited that we've now added a studio to heaven. The people there, the crew that you're working with, although you're working all the time, they chat to you between takes, between lighting setups. And they want to know about your life before, and they want to know about your life through film. because they're equally obsessed. And the first thing they ask is, what is the first film you remember seeing, Neil Marshall?
The first film that I remember seeing was Mary Poppins. I believe that was the first film that I saw at the cinema, but it's certainly the first film I ever remember watching, yeah.
Where was this that you saw that wonderful film?
I'd have to say, I couldn't tell you exactly. I have to say it was some cinema in Newcastle. There was a cinema just outside Newcastle, a place called Gosforth, where my dad grew up, called The Royalty, and they used to do a lot of like retro screenings and things, and I suspect that it might have been there, because I spent a lot of time over the next 10 years watching kind of retro screenings of films there. My dad would take me to see like 2001 and things like that there.
So your dad took you a lot to the cinema? You go with your dad?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, he's a movie fan as well. He loves his Westerns. He's a big Western fan. But yeah, I mean, we were big on like going to the cinema as a family. And, you know, I think that really got me into it.
How do you have siblings?
I have an older sister.
Okay.
3 years older, yeah.
And so you'd go all together?
Sometimes they'd go stuff and, you know, we'd be stuck on with the babysitter. And then later on, of course, we'd go, you know, go on our own and things like that. But there was a lot of times when we'd all go as a family.
Love it. Mary Poppins is magnificent.
It is. It's I watched it again recently, and I mean, I love the effects work. The matte paintings are just beautiful, whatever. And it's a lot longer than I remember it being. It's like I remembered it being sort of like a little neat 90 minutes, but it's quite long. It's like over 2 hours or something.
Yeah, it's really long.
Epic.
It's,
epic.
It is amazing. I'm so glad you like practical effects.
I got hooked on that, yeah, throughout the 80s, just got hooked on practical effects for sure.
I'm sure you've discussed this. I really don't understand the CGI, like Godzilla versus Kong. I'm like, I genuinely don't get it. Like, I'm like, this is a computer game. I'm watching a computer game. I'm watching two computer games fight each other.
Yeah.
Why? I'm not connected to it.
Yeah. I don't get it either. It's not something I particularly, just two massive computer generated things bashing each other up, seeing buildings getting smashed to bits. It's like, I've seen it. What, you know, the first time it was impressive. Now it's like, ugh. Yeah, I'm not a big fan of that whole
okay, good
genre.
What's the film that made you cry the most?
Field of Dreams.
Shit, yes.
Again, you know, like so many of the films are from that particular period, but I think, you know, the first time that I saw Field of Dreams, just that ending just killed me.
And you're close with your dad, aren't you? Or you were?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think it's obviously like I've tried over the years to like show it to girlfriends and things like that, and they're kind of like, don't get it. You know, it's a guy thing. It's clearly it's a guy thing, and it's not specifically like an American guy thing. I know it's about baseball or whatever, but it's about the connection with your dad and you know, regrets and stuff like that. My dad's still kicking around, so I got to make sure that I don't have those regrets. But yeah, that just, you know, that bit at the end where he says, oh my God, it's my father, was just like, that just floored me. And you know, and Burt Lancaster as well, you know, it's like, you can't go back. Oh yeah. Just wonderful, wonderful film. Great score.
A fucking amazing film.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so surreal. For a job that I did, I was living in LA and I had to do a job in Toronto. And I'd been living in the States for a few years, and I thought, well, look, I can fly to Toronto, but like, what's the fun in that? I think I'll drive to Toronto from LA and see a little bit of this country that I'm living in, because it's the only way to see anywhere is to drive. So I drove from LA to Toronto, took 5 days, but I took a deviation in Iowa and went to the Field of Dreams, because it's still there, and tourists flock there every year, and you know, they still maintain it. I arrived there at like 6 a.m. on a frosty, not a snow-covered January morning, and watched the sun come up over the Field of Dreams with covered in snow and stuff in the house and everything. It's all there. And I was the only one around. It was just absolutely magical. Absolutely magical.
That's amazing. That's truly amazing. You know that book, the book that Field of Dreams is based on, Shoeless Joe, I believe it's as mad as this. The twist that is the end of the movie isn't a twist in the book. It's like the part of the setup. It's like, do this to do that. Mad.
I've not read the book. I've not really got a desire to read the book. Yeah. Not now.
Yeah, that's insane.
Yeah, I could gather the book is quite different, yeah.
Yeah. Now, Neil Marshall, you've made a lot of horror films. You've made a lot of excellent horror films. What's the film that scared you the most?
This one, I might have answered this one before. The film that has scared me the most, that gives my memory of it being the most terrifying experience watching a movie. I was young at the time. I watched it on an old black and white portable television around at my friend's house, and it was in his kitchen, and me and him watched it. And it was The Legend of Boggy Creek.
Go on.
And it's like one of the first mockumentaries. It's a mockumentary about Bigfoot, and it absolutely scared the shit out of me. I think I must have been, I don't know, 8 years old, something like that. And the fact that it was a mockumentary, I didn't know it was a mockumentary at the time. I thought it was a full-on documentary about Bigfoot. So I took it very, very literally. And walking home that night was, you know, a nervous experience. And the thing is, I've never watched the film since, because by all accounts, it's not a great movie. Right. And I kind of, I like clinging on to that memory that it was a scary film, because if I watch it now, it might disappoint me.
Yeah.
So I'm happy to not watch it again and just remember that experience, that it just scared the living daylights out of me.
You love horror films, right? That's
you.
What's your theory on why that is? As in, some people just hate them and don't want nothing to do with them. I love them. You love them. What is it?
I think it's exactly the same principle that some people don't like roller coasters. You know, it's a controlled adrenaline rush. It's trying to recapture something from our archaic Stone Age past of, you know, living in fear or being chased by lions or whatever the hell it is that you know, that got our adrenaline pumping in life. And most of us don't have that in life anymore. We wake up, we go to work, we go to the shops, we go to restaurants or whatever. We don't live in fear of much. So things like roller coasters and horror movies provide us with that, a little adrenaline rush based on fear, based on the possibility that something terrible might happen to us. But it's a safety net. You know, at the end of the day, we know we're going to get off the roller coaster, or we're going to walk out of the cinema and everything's going to be okay. So it's a little bit of a distraction, but it's a safe distraction.
Safe distraction.
And I think that's the only kind of comparison I can think of that makes sense. But it's any kind of adrenaline rush. I don't think it's like parachute jumping, because there's always a chance that your parachute might not open. Yeah. But with a horror movie, the credits are going to roll inevitably, yeah, and you know, you're going to walk out and it's going to be okay.
Do horror films still affect you now you make them and know so much of the nuts and bolts of it?
Not as much. I think you get to a point where you're oversaturation. I've watched so many that it takes a lot for one to really scare me. They can make me jump, but more so in like a theatrical experience when it's bigger and louder and darker and within the audience. You know, I admit to jumping in a few things, but on the whole, no. But weirdly, the one film that got me the most is another mockumentary recently. Oh, fucking hell. Yeah, of course, I'm going to say Hand Cut. I've forgotten what the freaking title is. Oh,
Lake Mungo?
It's Lake Mungo.
I was going to tell you to watch that if you hadn't seen it.
Okay, right. Yes. Sorry. So, yeah, the most recent movie that scared the shit out of me was Lake Mungo.
Incredible film.
And I absolutely love it. I just, yeah. It's so well done. And the payoff, what it builds up to, that payoff at the end just absolutely floored me. And yeah, I got in touch with the director in Australia, and was like,
"No
I
wanna, way, tell me like, everything."
Well, I just want to know what he's doing next. I want him to do some more stuff, and I don't think he has. But yeah, I just thought he did such a great job with that film.
Yeah, he's vanished, right? What did he say to
he
you?
Has. What's he doing? This was a few years ago now, so I haven't been in touch since. But you know, fingers crossed. Touch wood, he'll come out of the woodwork and do something else, because like it was so accomplished as a first feature, and I loved all the twists and turns I just didn't see coming at all. It's great, loved it.
It's entirely of all the kind of mockumentaries as well. I think it's the most believable. It's like 100% believe
the performances are great. It's a good
fucking
one.
Great film. Good shout. What's the film that people don't really like? It's not critically acclaimed, but you love it unashamedly.
For me, that's going to be Waterworld.
I like Waterworld.
I think there's a lot of people hate on it, and obviously like reviews and all this kind of stuff, but I just love it. I just like unashamedly like enjoy that movie. I think it's daft, and it's the production design and the action sequences are great. I kind of like that it's one of the last sort of movies pre-CG, that a lot of it was done practically, that set that they built. I mean, and it's such a lunatic thing. It was kind of like a more modern version of Apocalypse Now, and just how daft they were to go out in the middle of the ocean and build that set. And there's moments like when I think it's the aircraft appears and it's like dragging along guys on water skis and things like that. And you're kind of thinking, all you need now is Ride of the Valkyries playing over this. It's perfect. But yeah, I love Waterworld. I think it's wonderfully daft.
It is. I like anything that's a bit fucking mad. And it's got this sense of, like, even the fact that he has gills. I love that he has gills.
Yeah.
I mean, it's all over the shop, but it's good.
I love that whole post-apocalyptic thing anyway, yeah, with Mad Max and all that lot. So it just fit into that world with the vehicles and the creation. He has the best, like, boat ever.
Yeah.
It's a very cool boat. Yeah. It's just a guilty pleasure for sure.
Respect.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Hacks is back for season 3, and so is the official Hacks podcast. In each episode, Hacks creators Lucia Aniello, Paul W. Downs, and Jen Statsky speak with cast and crew members to unpack the Emmy-winning comedy series. You'll hear Hannah Einbinder and Jean Smart speak to their on-screen dynamic, along with Hacks writer and actor Pat Regan, on how their improv experience helped them when shooting scenes and what it was like writing scripts for specific actors.
You'll also hear from crew members like the costume designers on what it was like creating the world that Deborah and Ava inhabit. Hear stories from the show's writer's room, on-set antics, and more. Watch Hacks streaming exclusively on Max, and listen to the official Hacks podcast on Max or wherever you get your podcasts.
What is a film that you used to love, but you've seen it recently and you do not like it anymore, for whatever reason that might be?
I don't know that I ever 100% loved it, because it came out the same year. It was kind of in direct competition with Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. And I'm a full-on indie nut. It's Tim Burton's Batman.
Oh, God.
And I watched it again recently and I thought it was terrible.
Really?
It seems like so much of the energy of that movie and the focus of that movie has been put on Jack Nicholson, that there's nothing, like the Batman is like he's a side character. He's like non-existent. You don't really get to understand him or anything like that. But not when you compare it to the things that have come since and Nolan's Batmans that really are explorations of that character and that psyche. And even the next one, I mean, Batman Returns is brilliant.
Brilliant.
But the first one, I just find it a big empty shell of a movie. It's like, you know, great sets, but sorry, I know it's a sacrilege, but it's like
sacrilege.
But is it? I don't know. Am I the only one out there? But yeah, I just was really disappointed in it watching it again.
Interesting. So, yeah. Well, as long as you like Batman Returns, I'm fine.
Well, I love that, and I love, you know, the majority of Tim Burton's movies, but just that one just left me cold. And it really was because that I didn't feel he explored the Batman character very much. Mm.
Listen, Last Crusade is a better film. Sure, I can agree with that.
Yeah, I'd say so. Okay. But I kind of thought it was then as well. So
yeah. Although, in defense of Tim Burton's Batman, it was the first, really, of these big comic book superhero movie type things that was trying to do something. And I think, I haven't watched it in a long time, but my memory of it is he's really trying to make something like a film noir, like it almost seems black and white. And he also is being told he's got to put like a Prince soundtrack in the middle of it. Like it feels like he's being made to do some stuff. He's trying to do something else.
Yeah, true.
And
true.
He half achieves it. And Michael Keaton's great.
Well, Michael Keaton is great, but he's underserved by that script, I think.
Fair, fair, fair. What is the film that means the most to you? Not necessarily the film's any good, but because the experience you had around seeing it, that will always make it special to you.
Well, it's back to horror again. And it's the experience that means the most to me. It was an incredible experience. The film itself is one of my favorites. It's an American Werewolf in London. But the experience was seeing it. And I think it was when the Blu-ray came out. And they showed it at Fright Fest in the Empire, Leicester Square. And I got to sit next to John Landis during the movie. And as part of the experience, he also brought along the making of Thriller and screened that before American Werewolf. And basically throughout the entire film, he gave a live commentary to both things to anyone who was listening in his immediate vicinity. And so, you know, and when you're watching American Werewolf in London and suddenly like John Landis like leans in close and like says, oh, that was filmed just outside these doors, or, you know, so we were watching in the Empire Leicester Square, literally 100 yards away from Piccadilly Circus where the finale's filmed. Just the whole thing of like, holy shit, John Landis is sitting next to us, giving us a live commentary of American Werewolf in London, and we're sitting in London and near Piccadilly Circus, was like, that's awesome.
That is cool.
That's suddenly like, this is why I'm doing what I do.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
That's
stuff.
That's fucking great.
That was cool.
Good answer. Neil Marshall, what is the film that you relate to the most?
Well, I mean, if you talk about now, I'm not sure. It might be like some midlife crisis movie or something like that. I'm not quite sure what that would be. You know, City Slickers or something like that. But for a long, long time, I'd say the film that I relate to the most was Breakfast Club.
Really?
Yeah.
Who were you in the Breakfast Club, or were you everyone?
I was Brian. I was the obsessive nerd.
Michael Hall?
Yeah.
Were the one his dad wanted him to get all the A's or something?
I think his dad wants him to get all the A's, but he's obsessed about making this thing, this lamp. I think it's an elephant, and if you pull the trunk, the light comes on. Something like that. I can't remember exactly what it is, but it's like he's obsessed with this thing of like making it work. And I thought, yeah, that's me. That's me trying to build something or whatever, trying to make a film work. It's like, yeah. So I think that really kind of connected me. Not that I was going to like shoot myself with a flare gun or anything like that, like Ryan was going to do, but. Yeah, the obsessive nerdiness of that character like really struck a chord, especially seeing it in the 80s when I was a nerdy teenager. So I was like, wow, there's somebody else out there like me.
That's nice to hear. Can I ask you something? You're clearly always been into the craft of it, the making the stuff, the building the stuff. How do you find... I've never worked with you. I have no idea what you're like on set in terms of... Are you like a shouty person? Are you calm? Are you how are you with all the people management side of directing, if I may ask?
Well, I like to think that I'm good with the people, as in I love the crew. I think I'm very much a part of the idea that every single member of the crew is a cog in a big machine, and there is no, it cannot work without all the cogs. So every single person, be it a runner or a producer or whatever, is as important as anybody else and should be treated with equal respect. So I very much that. I'm not a shouter. I'm not a screamer. I don't see any point in that. I always figure that a crew will work harder for you and do longer hours and do all the things that are difficult if they want to, not because they feel they have to. And so barking and screaming at people does not achieve that. You want that sense of camaraderie on set that everybody's actually working to the same purpose. So sharing thoughts, sharing your feelings about the movie is really important to get people on board, and sharing your passion for it, sharing your love of it. And all of that's about just like having a great time on set, because I feel I'm incredibly lucky to do what I do. And it's hard enough work. We do stupid hours and crazy things in weird places. It's hard enough without having people shouting and screaming. Just to be there and do it is fantastic, and I love it. So I think being on set is like one of my favorite places ever, and I want to make everybody else feel the same way, that it should be a joy to come to work and just do something ridiculous every day. That's kind of the way I do it.
I'm so glad I asked that question, because that is a wonderful answer, and I'm glad that you said it. What is, Neil Marshall, what's the sexiest film you've ever seen?
Well, for a long time I thought it was Battle Beyond the Stars.
I get it.
You know, you've got an entire generation who, Princess Leia, Star Wars, all, you know, dressed in white, the boobs taped down or whatever it was that she had to do, that Lucas was very keen to sort of desexualize her for whatever reason, because he obviously had a change of heart by Return of the Jedi. But before Return of the Jedi came along, there was Sybil Danning in Battle Beyond the Stars. And for you know, a young teenage boy, this was something quite unusual. And... And
do you
yeah.
think that was, that must have been it? That was a real conscious decision from Battle Beyond the Stars. We're like, well, we'll do.
Oh, that was Leia, absolutely. That's like, we're not going to, we're going to do the anti Princess Leia.
Yeah.
This is going to be like, you know, everything out for the universe to see. Crazy. Without resorting to cheap nudity, you know, you become more discerning as you grow older. But, you know, for a teenage kid, it was like, yeah, that's sexy. That's hot. She's hot.
That's great. Now, Neil Marshall, there's a subcategory to this question: troubling boners, worrying wide-ons. What film did you find arousing that you thought maybe you shouldn't have?
It's funny because I listened to Edgar's podcast of this as well, and like he said, what is the obvious answer? That very few filmmakers will put something in a film and not, you know, like accidentally making something sexy is quite, they want something to be sexy or they don't. But then sometimes you get something that's randomly sexy in an unexpected place. But I can't think that there's anything like really surreal or odd that comes to mind. It is something that involves like beautiful women, but it was in an unexpected place would be, and it's another sci-fi film from the 80s, was the opening credits of the theatrical version of Buck Rogers in the 25th Century.
Go on, I don't know about that.
Well, the TV show was, very sanitized or whatever, but in the opening credits of the American version, which was screened theatrically, they had all these, like, what was it, Erin Gray, who's Wilma Deering or whatever, and all these other women from the cast, like flouncing around in skin tight suits and like this soft undergo. It looks like a Tony Scott video,
right?
Pouting at the camera and stuff like that, which was unexpected when I went to see Buck Rogers. It was like, oh, hello.
was an unprepared bonus.
But at the end of the day, it's like I'm not worried about it because it was like, you know, hot women looking hot. So
you're healthy. You've got a healthy brain. Nothing to worry about.
Okay. I couldn't think of anything that was like that worried me.
That's good. There's no judgment here.
Fine. I'm curious to know what other answers you've had on that one.
it's a tricky. Most people. I always think Nish Kumar did the best answer, where I was like, yes, that's exactly like that was a very honest answer. Which was the scene in Sorry to Bother You where Tessa Thompson is doing a kind of weird art show where she's on stage, but she's kind of being pelted with food and it's sort of, the stuff is being thrown at her. And he was like, I'm sorry. I loved it.
maybe it's a food fetish.
Yeah, exactly. What's objectively, the greatest film of all time?
Since I can't say Raiders of the Lost Ark, I'm going to say Lawrence of Arabia.
Nice.
You know, as far as like over 4 hour films go, yeah. Lawrence is a film that I can watch any day of the week and never get bored. It's also like, it's like the biggest, most personal movie I can think of. Like this does such, to tell such an intimate portrait of a character on such an epic canvas. There's nothing else like it, I don't think.
Yeah.
And I just love every moment of it, every part of it. It's an amazing film.
It really is good. I saw it at the Secret Cinema. Secret Cinema did it. Did you?
Oh, wow.
Were you there for that?
I've not been to one of them. I need to go to one of them.
It was actually the first time I'd seen it as well. And it was like, you know, this whole fucking mad thing or whatever. And then you ended up in this huge place where it looked like the desert, and you kind of lay on pillows, and then they just had this massive kind of warehouse screening of Lawrence of Arabia, and it was pretty fucking special.
That's great. I've seen it projected on 70mm and things like that, and chased down whenever it does get projected is worth seeing on the big screen. Absolutely,
you're right. It's not as it. I think it took me years to watch it because it's the sort of film that looks like it'll be boring. Like it looks like, oh, this is going to be hard work.
But that's the thing. It is. Slow, it's long and it's slow, but it's never boring. There's always something to absorb you, something amazing to watch or something like that. I don't know. I can't.
It's a great film.
I love it enough. It's amazing.
Also, if your answer is Raiders of the Lost Ark, but you feel like you can't say it because lots of people have said it, you can say it. I'll let you have it.
Well, only because that is the movie that made me want to make movies. Yeah. It's the movie that it's still number one on my list of greatest movies as far as I'm concerned. It just ticks every box for me. I just love it.
It's got Lawrence of Arabia vibes.
It has.
It's got direct references
certainly,
to it.
Certainly watched that a few times beforehand. Yeah.
What's the film that you could or have watched the most over and over again?
That isn't Raiders of the Lost Ark. The thing is, there's a holy trinity for me of Raiders, Jaws, and Close Encounters, which is like,
really?
I think is like Spielberg's, the peak. And I know people want to throw E.T. in there and other things as well, but like for me, those three just boom. That's just amazing. And I've watched them more times than I can count. But films that I could watch again and again and again, to be honest, I tell you what, I love any of the most recent, like, from number three onwards, but definitely four, five, and six of the Mission Impossible movies.
Yeah, yeah.
I think they are almost flawless, brilliantly executed, incredibly entertaining, exciting, funny. They just tick all the boxes, and yeah. I can watch them again and again and again. Yeah, I just think they've done. They just it's like it's as a franchise, it just seems to get better and better and better.
Yeah,
and you can't knock that.
You can't. I love them. What was I going to say to you about? Oh, Close Encounters. Maybe you know all of this, but I'm going to tell you. Close Encounters. And for those who haven't seen it, this is a spoiler. So stop listening or skip forward 5 minutes. You should see it. It's amazing. Richard Dreyfuss leaves his family to go on the spaceship.
Yes.
Which I always thought, for me, is one of the reasons I think that film is amazing, because it's complicated, because he does it's abandon his family, goes mad, and he follows his obsession and it right to the end, but sacrifices his family, who don't seem bad people. You know, it's like, it's really complicated and interesting. Steven Spielberg has subsequently said, I wouldn't make that now. I'd never have him leaving his family. Now I have kids. I couldn't have made Close Encounters because I couldn't have him leaving his family. And then yeah. I heard Richard Dreyfuss on an interview. Someone put that to him, said, Steven Spielberg says he shouldn't have left his family. And Richard Dreyfuss said, well, Steven Spielberg's wrong. Get him on the phone, because of course he has to leave his family, he has to go to his thing. And I find that so interesting that he's changed his mind on this. And I get it. I mean, I get that he must have had kids and thought, I could never abandon my children or whatever. I can't even get in that headspace. But yeah. I think that's what's so interesting about that film. It's so complicated. It isn't just a straightforward thing.
I think that's why that film is like a product. You know, that film is right on the barrier between, you know, the films of the 80s and the films of the 70s. And so much of that film is actually a product of the 70s and the way that, you know, it's Watergate and things like that, which makes it more kind of complex and more political and more interesting. That if that film had been made 5, 6, 7 years later, it would have been a very different thing. And probably more kind of fun and easygoing and not challenging. But that's what I love about it, is the fact that it is challenging. And if he did make it now and he didn't get on the spaceship at the end, it would be a crushing disappointment. I never assumed that he was going to go away forever. So the other people that were on the spaceship came back. People go on spaceships now, you know, they go up in space and they come back. They're not abandoning their families. So
idea. So you think he comes back and makes it up to his family?
Yeah, maybe. Maybe, you know, he gets it out of his system. He comes back and he heals whatever needs healing with his family.
Love that.
But to change it and have him just kind of go, I can go on the spaceship or I can go home. Yeah. I'll go home. Like, well, that's why did I go through the whole journey with you?
We've got to get Dreyfuss on the phone and tell him, listen, you can come back in a couple of years, make it up with your family, it'll be fine.
Yeah, Dreyfuss's return. Yeah.
That's fascinating. Oh yeah, I'd forgotten that people come back. Yeah.
Another Close Encounter story is on another road trip that I did, this time to Canada. From LA to Canada, I went on a very, very wide detour into Wyoming and stopped by Devil's Tower. And it was a religious experience. It was surreal. Yeah. It was like coming over a hilltop and seeing Devil's Tower in reality. It was so surreal and just amazing. Just amazing. Yeah.
This is great. You're living your best life. We don't like to be negative, so we'll do it fairly quick. What's the worst film you've ever seen?
I've seen so many terrible movies. And I've seen so many. I mean, there's terrible movies that know they're terrible, or that they were made with such heart and soul that you love them. Mm-hmm. And they're great for different reasons. And you can't fault them for that, because it's like, okay, they didn't come out as maybe they were intended, but you could feel the passion that went into them regardless. And I love them for that. We enjoy them for that on a different level maybe than they were intended, but whatever, that's fine. But then there's films that are just bad for other reasons. And I'm going to be controversial here and say that I think one of the worst films I've seen in a long time was Skyfall.
Interesting. Tell me everything.
Well, I think it's one of the most sexist Bond films, especially as far as the Moneypenny character is concerned, like, you know, let's put a woman in the field. Oh, she's terrible at it. She shoots Bond. She lets the bad guy get away because she's already shot Bond on the train, and she could have shot the bad guy off the train. She had a clear shot, but now she just watches him. She just watches him go away. That annoyed the hell out of me. By the end of the film, she's taken out of field service and reduced to being a secretary because that's all she's good for. And I just thought, God, this is like unbelievably backwards.
Yeah, and Judy Dench gets killed, and then Ray Fiennes takes over, like back to men in charge. Thank you.
So it just seems like such a backward step. And there's also like lots of stuff within the plot of that just makes absolutely no sense at all. You know, Javier Bardem as the undercover operative in China. Like, he's not exactly going to blend in, is he? and then the chase through the underground with the ridiculously convenient underground train that crashes through the roof, which is at rush hour, but there's absolutely nobody on it. Just like so many things like that, that just like not up to the quality of like Casino Royale, which is an amazing Bond film.
Yeah.
And certainly not up to the quality of the Mission Impossible movies. And I just thought it kind of let the side down a bit. It certainly has some good points in it, like Roger Deakins' photography is beautiful. But I just, especially as far as the money thing, Money Penny thing, was just made me angry.
Yeah, it's mad. You're right. Fuck Skyfall. I want to ask you about the film that made you laugh the most, but I'm also interested in how you feel about comedy. You know it, the connection between comedy and horror and how they both have a certain way of eliciting a response. How do you feel about comedy?
I think comedy is harder than horror. The comedy is very, 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 very complex. Horror can be complex, absolutely, but there's kind of a cheap... Well, actually, no, there's cheap ways to comedy as well, but they just annoy me. The cheap way of horror is to do the jump scare, whereas the cheap way of comedy is to have somebody fall over, which seems to be like the staple of a lot of American comedy films, is that the big joke is that people just falling over or bump into slapstick, basic slapstick. Yeah. Okay? The peak of slapstick was Lauren Hardy, Buster Keaton, Charlie Chaplin, that period. And it's never got better than that. So I go for more the comedy that I like. And I'm just going to completely overturn what I've just said, because I was just thinking one of the things that makes me laugh is Peter Sellers in The Return of the Pink Panther when he falls over. But it's the way that he falls over. But that's not the best thing in the entire movie. It's just a very funny moment. Life of Brian, I think, is probably the film that just every time, just every single scene just destroys me. Specifically the scene in which the characters are trying not to laugh. You know, Biggest Dicketh, and that scene, to put an audience through that when the characters are trying not to laugh and the whole point is trying to laugh, is one of the most hilarious and clever scenes of all time. And I love that. I absolutely love it. But I do like Peter Sellers. I do like the Pink Panther. But I think Life of Brian takes the biscuit for me for the most consistently funny film.
It's an amazing film. I think your thing about it's how Peter Sellers, you know, everything can be done classy as fuck.
Falling over can be very funny in the right hands.
Yeah, and it can be elevated. I think there's a jump scare in The Descent that is high art, that is incredible, like properly fucking hell, and is in no way cheap. It's fully earned, and you've built this whole thing.
Is that the infrared thing?
Yeah,
that we worked hard at that. We did. Yeah. I think that we did about 7 or 8 takes. Well, one of the things that we did with that was, first of all, just to go back and talk about this, I kept the creatures hidden from the cast.
Oh, wow.
They weren't allowed to see any drawings, any design things, anything about the creatures. They weren't even allowed to meet the actors who were playing the creatures. And because we filmed it in story order for the most part, we got to that point in the story where they were going to meet the creatures for the first time. And we set up that shot, which was the first time they encounter the creatures, because it takes place in the dark. So we kind of set it up in the dark, and we brought the creature on stage for the first time in the dark and put him into the scene and let it run and let's see what happened. But the first take was that they turned on and saw him and they all ran screaming for the exit. So that was kind of unusable by this point. And on the first few takes as well, I had him, he was kind of reaching for one of them. He was like reaching out to touch one of them.
Yeah.
We tried that and I was like, it's okay. What if you're just standing there? Well, like, what if you're just kind of standing there with like your head slightly lopped on one side and just kind of listening to them and just being there like some like weird pervert in the background? So that's what we did. And that's the one that's in the movie. And it's just like, for some reason, just the fact that he's not doing anything, he's just kind of standing there.
Yeah.
Makes it all the more disturbing and shocking. And then, of course, you put a big loud noise on it and shriek and everybody screams and, you know, the audience goes through the roof every time.
That's giving me a buzz, that story. I love that. That's fucking great. I love that. You hid them from the actors. Fuck, that's cool.
That was a fun thing to try. You know, it was just like, oh, let's just not let them see them. Don't get them comfortable.
When you finally got the take you were happy with, were you like, This is the creature. Hello, how are you doing? Nice to meet you. Did everyone then chat?
Or yeah, by that, by that point, I think afterwards they all kind of like hung out, whatever. Because right. there's another scene. The little girl in the film is my niece, who was only like 6 at the time, and there had to be a scene where she was going to be in the same shot as the creature. So I was like, oh, how am I going to? I don't want to give her nightmares, but how are we going to do this? But it was literally like, okay, the easiest way to do this is be as matter of fact as possible. Just walk her up to the guy and say hi. And we came up to the place, and the creature who's Craig Conway, like turned around in full makeup and was just like, oh, hello, how do you do? So surreal.
Love that a lot. Neil Marshall, I've enjoyed this so much. You've been brilliant and I really appreciate it. However, when you were making The Descent, we went back in time, and you'd made these creatures, and you were preparing. What happened was you'd hidden them from the other actors and you'd hidden them from everyone, and you were in the dark and you went, hey, guys, you got one of the creatures. You said, hey, come here. Come on to set. And it was dark, so no one could see you. Come on, because I'm going to surprise the other actors. Just shh, come on. And you were like giggling. You were all excited about it. It's going to be so great.
Yeah,
and, I was. and it was going to be so great. And the creature that you had created, you'd done the makeup, you'd built the thing, everything. You couldn't see them very well. You were holding their hat. Come with me, come with me. And then they just suddenly bit you. And you went, whoa, hey, what's going on? That wasn't the script, and we haven't started shooting yet. They bit you again. You were like, hey, hang on a second. And then he bit you. And then you were like, oh my God. And you were screaming on the floor. The rest of the cast, the crew, they could hear all this, but they were like, oh, Neil's practicing something.
Exactly. He's just rehearsing.
He's rehearsing something. Just let him do his thing. And then you were like, no, help. And they were like, yeah, help is in the script. Someone does say that. He's just running lines. And this creature tore you apart to bits, and then you were dead. And then the first AD was like checking his watch and like, I don't like to push things along, but we are running behind now. We haven't seen Neil for a while. And anyone goes, eyes on Neil, any eyes on Neil? No one's got eyes on Neil. They go, let's put the lights on just for a second, see if we can find Neil. They turn on the lights. Everyone fucking screams to high heaven.
Yes.
Because you are
in pieces.
An absolute fucking mess on the floor.
Yeah.
And one of the creatures is still eating a bone of yours, and he looks up at everyone, and everyone goes, what have you done? And he goes, sorry.
Yeah, just got a bit method there.
Yeah, got a bit carried away. And the other actors have never seen these creatures. They all scream. Everyone runs out. Everyone leaves the set. Terrified. I come in. I'm just wandering about Pinewood. You know what I'm like. Got a coffin with me. You know how I do. And I'm walking around, and I see you, absolute state on the floor. Oh God, what a shame. I really wanted him to finish this film, I thought. Anyway, come over, collect the pieces of you that are available.
Scoop me up.
Scoop up what I can, but there's bits of cave stuck to you, fake cave, all sorts of stuff congealed with the blood.
It's a
real mess. I really have to peel you up. Smash you up, get you in this coffin, but there's more of you than I was expecting. Coffin is absolutely rammed. There is only room in this coffin for me to slip one DVD in the side for you to take to the other side. And on the other side, it's movie night every night. What film are you taking to show everyone on movie night when it's your night, Neil Marshall? Go.
I'm going to take Big Trouble in Little China.
What a twist!
And not only for the film, you know, because it's more than just a film. I was thinking, like, what has also the best extras on it as well, so you can get multiple, like, more use out of it. And nice. Big Trouble in Little China has one of the best commentaries of all time on it with Kurt Russell and John Carpenter. And Kurt Russell is basically just kind of laughing his ass off the whole way.
Oh, great.
And it's very entertaining and amusing, and it just makes you feel good. So I think that would be a good thing, because not only the film itself is awesome, but you get the commentary and the making of and all this extra stuff to boot.
That is a really well-argued answer, and you can have it. Neil Marshall, I've loved this. Is there anything you would like to tell people to look out for, to listen to watch coming up for you?
Yeah, the new movie, The Reckoning, is coming out on April 16th. I guess it's on video on demand and Blu-ray at the same time, I think.
Okay.
If not, certainly on iTunes and Amazon and things like that. So on VOD. So yeah, that came out in the US in February, and we were hoping beyond hope that cinemas would be open again by April. It seems that's not the case, sadly. So we're not going to get the theatrical release we were hoping for, but still it's worth checking out.
I will watch it with the lights out at least. That's the least I can do. Yeah. Phones off, lights out.
And I've got another kind of scrawny, slightly slimy creature in there as well, which is, you know, it's cool. Not another crawler, but something else. Yes.
Okay, very exciting. All right, that's April 16th. Well, this will be coming out later, so that means watch The Reckoning. It's already out.
If you haven't already, yeah, get it watched.
Neil Marshall, what a treat. Thank you so much for doing this. I hope you have a lovely death. Good luck in Budapest. And
thank you.
Take it easy on the other side.
Oh, it's been a blast. It's been a blast.
Thanks, man.
Cheers.
So that was episode 145. Head over to patreon.com/Brett Goldstein for the extra 15 minutes of chat, secrets and video with Neil. Go to Apple Podcasts, give us a 5-star rating, and instead of writing about the show, write about the film that means the most to you and why that is. I do like reading it, and it also helps numbers, and it means Maureen can keep drinking craft beer or whatever it is she's into this week. Thank you so much to Neil for doing the show. Thanks to Scroobius Pip and the Distraction Pieces Network. Thanks to Buddy Peace for producing it so brilliantly. Thanks to Acast for hosting it. Thanks to Adam Richardson for the graphics and Lisa Latham for the photography. Come and join me next week for another excellent guest. Who will it be? I won't tell you. You'll have to find out. So that is it for now. I hope everyone is well. In the meantime, have a lovely week. And please, now more than ever, be excellent to each other. Sometimes I dream of becoming an actor. Have you ever dreamt of becoming an actor? Maureen, what is it you think I do for a living? Never mind, sounds like you need the New York Film Academy. NYFA offers workshops, BFA and MFA degrees and summer camps in filmmaking, acting, journalism and more, online and on campuses across the globe. To make films alongside industry professionals, explore more at nyfa.edu. Thanks, Brett. Thank you, Maureen.
Maureen, your Canva presentation looks brilliant. Thanks, Brett. That's because I used AI-powered Canva presentations. I just described what I wanted, and Canva presentations generated the perfect slides. You can even make a talking presentation for people to watch on their own time. Check this out. Recording. 101 Reasons Why Beaches is the Saddest Film Ever Made by your neighbour Maureen. Is it easy to use? If you can use a computer, you can nail your next work presentation with Canva Presentations at canva.com, designed for work. Oh, thanks, my name is Maureen. Yeah, thank you.